Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. We're just two aunties sharing our experience through the lens of one Blackfoot woman and one Anishinaabe woman. And we are Indigenous Vision, an educational nonprofit based in Montana and Arizona. We are 100% Indigenous led, and this is our podcast. Check us out at indigenousvision.org to learn more about our work, make a donation, or play back any of our radio shows and this episode.
Hello and welcome to the Ivy Podcast, episode 85. It feels like it's been an eternity since we've been here.
It does. I took a couple weeks off for my health, and it was like physical health. I had an outpatient surgery, which I thought was minor, but then I looked it up and it said it's major. How are you? You went crazy places. I was kind of delirious in the first week of the time we took off.
You're right. I think the last time we were on the podcast, I was semi whining about how I was scared to go down this like road with a car by myself in Death Valley, in like remote Death Valley. I didn't go down that road, but I did go into Death Valley and experience an amazing time two new moons ago. I know that's really celestial way to describe the time, but it was during the new moon, so like I could stargaze, and like I went to the Death Valley Star Camp and saw into the universe in a way that I've never seen before. So I saw another galaxy, Suta. I saw the Andromeda galaxy, which is going to collide with our galaxy in like 500 million years or something like that. But I saw that galaxy. I saw Jupiter and its stripes. I saw a lot of constellations. I learned a lot, and I got to meet some really cool desert folk. It looks so vast and barren there, but when you get close up, there's like people hanging out in the desert all over the place. Mm-hmm. So cool. And then I went to San Francisco as well.
And the desert is so beautiful, and it's alive. It's not barren or
right.
Anything.
There is much life. There is a lot of life. And I think right now there's going to be a super bloom due to all the rain that this part of the country has been experiencing. So I'm excited for that. I mean, it feels like life is catching up with itself over the past 3 years. I personally feel like I'm coming out of like a weird fog.
I think it's going to be a significant year this year, because tonight is a night where five planets line up for the first time in a very long time. Our ancestors watched this happen. And it's just cool. We usually get cloudy days here when there's usually a celestial event. And I'm hoping for we didn't get to see the Northern Lights. And I guess the Northern Lights were really amazing just a couple days ago. But yes, I'm so happy to be back. And I feel like we have so much to catch up on. I didn't get to that bullet pointed list, but I have a dog squeaking in the background now.
How's dog life, or dog mom life, for you again? Welcome back, by the way. Round of applause.
Thank you. Idumaka. Yes, I'm talking about you. He is I think he's 35 pounds Cocker Spaniel, and he came from Texas, and he's got his AKC papers, and his old owner just got a job that he couldn't keep him on the kind of schedule that he needs. He's a really active dog, and like his walk is at a jog pace. And so Working Dogs for Conservation assessed him, and the only kind of, I guess, if a dog can get a bad mark is his kenneling, is he doesn't like to be alone in his kennel, and he cries.
I would probably do the same thing, probably scream actually.
Yes, I know. I've accidentally called it, because this is the first time I've had a kennel dog, and I've accidentally called it a cage a couple times. And my son is like, "Mom, cage is really cruel." And I'm like, "Yes, it is."
Oh, that's awesome that Oni's like, "Hey,
please call it a kennel." And that way we're not sticking him in a cage, but it looks like a cage to me. But he's comfortable in there.
Good.
He's kennel trained, and so I just leave the door open, and I think if he hears a scary noise or something he doesn't know about, like bonking around in the house, he'll go sit in there and look around. But he's getting more comfortable.
How long has it been now? Because it's been like over a month since we had a podcast. So were talking about getting one.
I think we're going on, today is 3 weeks.
That's amazing. I can't wait to meet them.
I know, he is just adorable, and everybody at the dog training. So last week I went, it was really hard because for all of our listeners, I sit at home and write grants like a mad woman. And then I go out into the field and do the work. And so I'm out in the middle of nowhere, which is the dream job part of it. And then the hard part is like sitting down and begging people for the money and the value to do it. But it's just been like the last week was my first week at like a 9 to 5 Monday through Friday work event. And by Wednesday, I thought I was going to drop. Thursday, I got a second wind. Finally, I was like, I'm back. But I got my certificate in dog centered detection. And that's through, I think it's UK Rural Skills. And we had a trainer, her name was Louise, and she came over from Wales in the United Kingdom. And she has this amazing history of, I would love to have her on because she's, talk about women in amazing places like me, and has been a woman in a like men dominated fields and has had to work up and maneuver through those things. And she talked about it because she's a pretty blonde woman, right? And her dog is trained in bomb detection. And so she does global events and searches buildings for bombs, which is really like stressful because she's like, you turn on the radio and you like drive away from the event and you're like, I hope my dog, you know, talking about the relationship between the dog and the handler and how our lead is kind of like our umbilical cord to our dog and how like what our dog is smelling, seeing, detecting, and experiencing, because they can get into some serious trouble out there. And I was thinking about the trouble that we might get into, because at the training, we decided to train Iduma Mahka in search and rescue, which is live find. So in the first few hours of people going missing, they can call me. And if I can't make it out, like say I got my son has an event or something that I can't miss, then my assistant, Selena Gray, from the last episode can come pick him up too, because she's also, she got her certificate and is being trained as a handler in all of the same thing and more. We're hoping to get second dog and more dogs because we're trying to get her over into the northwest corners, because these dogs can also be trained to smell oil balls. And right now I learned the most amazing things at this training. And there's a few things that stuck with me. Right now we're using humans to test if oysters have oil in them, and they just slurp them up the way people eat, you know, oysters or clams or whatever they are. I'm not a seafood eater, and they slurp them up and then they assess the level of oil taste.
That's incredible.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, like, that's, I can't
believe people are like, would sign on to this job to willingly consume a carcinogen. So it turns out that dogs can smell these oil balls in the beach and under the sand. And then for our purposes over here in the Midwest, and as a consultant to pipeline companies and to nations and wanting to steward and manage their own, the pipelines running through their own lands, these dogs can run lines and smell a leak 10 feet underground that hasn't made it to the surface yet. Like in my job as a water person, there's typically an odorant that's added into natural gas or oil. And that way you can tell if there's a leak because there's a smell, right? That smell, the odorant that's added to the oil and gas mixtures, is what contaminates water along with the oil and the gas. But the odorant is also a huge contaminant to the water. And so then you have the oil, the gas, the odorant, and then this other chemical soup if it's a natural gas pipeline, right? But for oil, these dogs can smell that leak 10 feet down without the spill getting as big as the reaching the surface, which means they'll see, operators will see a drop in pressure somewhere along the line at check stations, monitor stations, and then get a dog out to run the line and find exactly where the leak is. Pretty amazing in terms of like spills, contamination, and cleanup. But you know, I always think that prevention is the best thing, and not having pipelines in places that contaminate critical habitat and cultural use.
Yeah, I'm amazed that the dogs can learn all of that in training. And that, you know, I like to make jokes about dogs, you know, as a cat owner, how dogs are the only like species that'll work for cops or whatever, but they do such great work, like seriously. And I'm amazed that in the 8 hours a day for 5 days, y'all went and learned that much and like are ready to like go in the field already.
Not yet. I'm in training as a handler.
Oh.
Getting there. So I got like, that was my basic dog awareness, learn your dog. There's basics to handling and reading a dog from its eyes to its body, to its tail, all these mannerisms. Because typically people are working with rescue dogs. And so a lot of these dogs have like, nobody can see my air quotes, like problems. I think there's only bad owners. I don't think there's bad dogs. I think there's something bad that happened to the dog that has caused that dog to lose trust with people. So yeah, I don't believe in bad dogs, but they can learn a lot. And so we're going to be training Itumamaka on live find. We'll be able to be called out in Montana. I think I'm willing to drive anywhere within 6 or 7 hours, which is like towards Billings area, and then zebra mussels. And we don't have, like, we're not a regulatory body, we're an educational body. And so I was just going to volunteer with the dog at different tribal check stops because they have boat checks, and show them like how fast a dog can work and hopefully get more dogs into tribal departments, because dogs are amazing at stopping zebra mussels. And I think if you travel through Montana and anywhere in the Northwest area, you'll see don't move a mussel. And these zebra mussels that just completely take over aquatic ecosystems. And you see a lot like bike frames dipped into the lake, and then they're completely covered in this mussel. That's them. And they take over and they completely eliminate food sources and just crash the ecosystem.
Yes, I've heard of those in my parts as well, up in Canada.
Yeah. Well, they're on the spread, and a lot of people who lose hope often say like, why monitor? It's not, it's like inevitable that they'll get everywhere, right? But we could slow the spread. And in that time, people get innovative, right? And I think I'm always hopeful, like, that here's my apocalyptic optimist side, right? I'm hopeful that this is the year that we're going to have those like scientific humanity innovations where the world just gets significantly better in some way. You know, we have them every few thousand years, like the invention of the toilet. Thank goodness no one's throwing their poo out the window anymore. Holy cow. But I'm hoping for one of those times.
you know what? I feel very optimistic too. And I know there's been like crazy bad news in the news today, but I'm still an optimist. I'm still hopeful. I'm still loving the gift of life that I have and enjoying it like moment to moment. So I think that's a really good lesson to keep in mind, especially top of mind when we're like scrolling around on our phones and, you know, overhearing things as much as we try to not absorb the media. There's still ways that it gets in, but I'm super optimistic about things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then we have to be careful as a society what we share and what we promote. Like if we spend all of our time sharing threads of things that perpetuate violence and division, that's what's going to happen naturally.
Exactly. Right? Totally.
And so I think we can all be responsible and take accountability with our social media feeds and only share things and try to share things. You know, I think we all fail sometimes.
Oh, for sure. I'm guilty. Like I see my failures and I'm like, damn, what was I going through that at that minute or that hour?
Exactly. I shared a Métis post, and like some mornings, like especially on the weekends, I go back and forth. This past weekend, I was having a weekend where I really didn't want to be connected to online. And so, but I did do a quick scroll and I shared a Métis article.
With almost no context,
right?
Like right, just a cold share.
I'm going to read this for later. And like, please be gentle on me, public, because it is my personal Facebook page. I'll share my kid and my dog and, you know, like, and then work. Yeah. And I don't know anything about Métis people, but I know there's a lot of of conflict there as well. And the conflict sometimes overrides the beauty of the community. And I think for me, I'm the audience who is a native who is viewing it. And my education level, I can't imagine what the average American or the average Canadian citizen's education level is around this, because mine as a Blackfoot person isn't very strong. I don't have any Métis people in my family. And I think I shut off because you explore your ancestry, right? And I learned something about Métis is French natives. And I'm like, oh, well, does Cabell, Joe Cabell, the French Italian guy, does that make me Métis? And then I learned that it was Cree and native, Cree and French mixture, which is the specific. And then there's some, that's where it gets diluted into.
Yeah, we have to refer back to our Métis episode that we did with Jules. Remember when Jules came on?
Yeah.
She's from a legit Métis family. And I think you have to have a certain lineage with a certain tribe or nation.
Right. That's what I thought. Like they were either landless. And then there was some specific families. So there was grandfather families. Right. And you can be Cree and French, but you can't be Métis unless you're from one of these families.
The Métis families, right? Yeah. I remember your post. It's about no one is really descendant from Louis Riel, which I was shocked because I didn't realize his children didn't have children. I didn't know that.
Really? And I just, that's...
Because I've heard people say, I'm a direct descendant of Louis Riel. And that just... shut that down.
Well, and then how do they know that a man doesn't have children if they're a traveling man?
True. I mean, I heard my grandpa's got a child out in Germany after his time in the war. I heard that he fathered a child. So I have an uncle somewhere out there in Europe.
Yeah. And this idea of illegitimate children is so colonial. That's like king and queen stuff. Like a child is your child.
Right.
No matter where you travel. And so there could be some validity to those people who say they are a direct descendant because they were, quote unquote, the illegitimate child.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, there's stories get complex, and that's what's interesting.
Especially in Indian country. I mean, come on, we are a special type of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My Siksika grandpa is probably actually Blackfeet and part Crow, but was actually enrolled in Siksika. And so that's just where my grandpa was when they did the treaty rolls and stuff like that. And so I'm guessing a lot of people's grandparents were like accidentally down in Browning when Siksika did their rolls, or accidentally up in Siksika when Blackfeet did their rolls. And so then...
That is very interesting. I have a cousin who's also named Melissa, and she was telling me that I'm from the direct bloodline of our initial chief who signed Treaty 2, because there was a bunch of them. So we are apparently from that original bloodline. She confirmed, and I believed her. I was like, you know what? That does make sense. That does make sense. Chiefs who saw it switches, goes back a couple hundred years, but still, it's cool to know that on my maternal side, that's where we come from.
A couple hundred years is not long in in First Nations timelines. What was his name?
Chief Soussance.
Soussance. Ooh, that's cool.
Soto Ojibwe Anishinaabe.
Ah, Sigapi.
Which is like the lake people, And then my dad is more to the west in Saskatchewan, right at the border.
It's so fitting that my bestie is a lake in.
I know. You got to come to Canada one day. I've been thinking about this. I'm like, one day you got to come to Treaty 1 and 2, which is where my families all live. And it is like wetland madness. I was just thinking about it the other day because I was in San Francisco and I was like, wow, it's so moist and rain. You could feel the rain in the air, right? And I'm like, man, it's probably so mushy right now where I'm from. And like, I'm like, Suta would just go crazy with all the water. Yeah, there's no mountains and you can see as far as you can see, but when you're standing on the ground, you can like feel the water underneath because it's just everywhere. Like it's absolutely everywhere.
That's amazing. I would love to go. And if you guys have zebra mussels, then I can go on that premise of trying to get some of the First Nations communities out there to send a community member out to get a dog trained up. Or maybe I can get a dog in and train it for zebra mussels, and one of the communities there can come down and just train to be a handler really quick, because that's a shorter training, I think. I can train the dog and then send the dog back with the handler. And the point of, you know, monitoring where it's already present is maybe there is a small lake where it isn't present. Maybe a contaminated air watercraft hasn't gone into that water body yet, because that's their way that they move. They move on our propellers. They move on our boats, kayaks, anything that goes into the water and there's a little crevice, they hide in there. And that's how they move. And then they just overpopulate the whole lake. But if we can somehow, like, say, here's a hypothetical situation. Say there's a Ojibwe man who is like a bushman living out by his lake and protecting his lake because he's connected in spirit to that lake. And he monitors it every day and eats all his food from that land right there. I can get him a dog, and he can, if we know the lake is clean, then he can monitor and sit there at his house, at the boat dock, monitoring all watercraft coming in. And if there's anything that's found, he can turn them away.
Holy moly, that would be amazing. Because it is the land of 10,000 lakes. That's what it's advertised as to settlers to come fish.
So we need to find out how many of those 10,000 lakes are not contaminated. And then we need that many volunteers.
Wow, that's a lifelong project. And a lot of dogs.
Oh, why do I do
that? All the barking and all the tail wagging.
I know. And then I saw on, I brought up I'm a member of this women's backcountry hiking group. The women got into it a little bit a few weeks ago. And I don't really remember it. I don't really remember 2-3 weeks ago very well. The pain was so blinding from that surgery for about a week and a half. But these women from my backcountry hiking group got into if dogs belong in the backcountry or in the wilderness. That was the exact words they said. Dogs don't belong in the wilderness. And I was like, well, first of all, wilderness is not wilderness. It's never been wild and it's never been untouched. There has always been a First Nation Indigenous person presence in every single wilderness across the entire continent. This is a well-used, long-used land. Second, if you're a Blackfoot woman like me, dogs have always been by our side. And every Blackfoot woman, think about the peak population of Blackfoot people and that expansion of across the continent that we have. If you look at the website and then you look at the Blackfoot place map and you see those orange, the orange mark on the Blackfoot place map, our place on this continent is huge. And every single Blackfoot woman in that territory had at least 2 or 3 dogs. We just know where to poop.
Right?
It's all about sanitation. It's all about sanitation. It's all about stewardship. And it's all about taking care of the water and the soil. That's what it's like to live as a Blackfoot person in our culturally historic way, is we moved camp before resources were exploited. We kept resources in known locations like piskuns, and those are corrals for bison, and buffalo jumps were also like tool sheds, essentially. So we didn't have to haul a bunch of stuff around with us. Everything was right where we knew it was. And we just moved seasonal homes to keep resources abundant. And so, yeah, every woman had a lot of dogs, and I'm sure other nations had their dogs too. And so this land was well used by both people and animal, and dogs have always been in the wilderness and are a vital function of the ecosystem.
How did the ladies react when you revealed this information to them?
I didn't. You choose your battles. And I think at that point, my neck surgery had kicked off a chronic migraine that was kind of like my right side in. So I decided to like not say anything to them. So this all went down in my head. But I might have mentioned that, you know, Roosevelt and Muir were mistaken.
That is a really colonial perspective to just think that it was just bush with just animals and there was nobody here. And it was just wildlife and tons of trees. And, but like there was an entire, you know, group of people for a millennium.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And those Great Lake area natives have the best, I mean, Salish Kootenai here in Montana is pretty awesome at their forest management. And us Blackfeets are reestablishing our prairie management and mountain management as well. But right around the Menominee, they have a forest management example that a lot of U.S. Forest Service departments are trying to adopt. And so they have this traditional knowledge that you pick the old, not the old, you pick the sick. There's a three tenets of it. The sick, it's kind of like animals, right? The sick, the dying, the dead. And then you don't even take all of those either. And then you, but the sick you do, because that's management, right? Wolves taught us you take the sickest one from the herd because it's going to make the other herd sick, right? And so this nation is, and I think it's on the map. I don't know if that map is published right now. It might be private right at this moment, but that method of forest management, and they move from an east to west, and it takes them years to move across their whole territory, right? Doing this method of pulling those logs. And then they go the other direction for a number of years and let that other section rest, kind of essentially, so there's no activity, but it mirrors their traditional stewardship methods. And then Blackfeet were called Blackfeet because we, you know, burned the prairie and made grazing habitat for buffalo and elk and all the hooved species. We have a special relationship with the hooved nations.
Wow, thank you for saying that. I have always wanted to know why it's Blackfeet.
Oh, really? Yes. Well, I think we were named by an enemy tribe. That's, you know, they what they saw about us, what they perceived, right? And so we call ourselves the Nitsitapi, which we are the real people.
Right.
Opposed to, or compared to.
But your street name is Blackfeet.
Yeah, my street name is Blood. My street name is Blood, right?
Blood. Oh my goodness. Blood. That sounds so vicious.
No, right?
Meanwhile, I'm just Ojibwe.
You're friendly.
I just want to go wade in the water and eat strawberries. People always try to mess with me, though.
I love strawberries too.
But that's beautiful. I'm glad that you mentioned the Great Lakes because I know it's sugar season right now. The maple sap is a flowing. So shout out to everybody there who is catching that and keeping the traditional way of doing that alive, because that's beautiful. And I am a maple syrup fanatic. In fact, I spend a long time in the grocery aisle trying to find like the most authentic one because I'm so far away from there.
Yeah. Yeah. We need a native maple distributor. And I thought those Tonka bars were going to be really awesome. You know, it was kind of like the first mainstream native product you saw in grocery stores. And they do pemmican bars.
I haven't seen those yet.
Yeah, there was another competitor that came in and bought them out. It's the main bar that we see now. That's the bison pemmican option that we have as like trail food bars. But
yeah, I thought pemmican was like survival food. That's what I always heard growing up. It was like, if you're eating pemmican, you're not doing good.
But what I would love to see in grocery stores is native companies that are making maple syrup. Oh, I would buy that. Rice, wild rice, tortilla, corn products. That would
be. Do you want to hear something crazy? There was a native grocery store in Winnipeg where I'm from. And it only lasted a few years and then it went under because nobody shopped there. It drove me crazy. It was called Nietzsche Commons and I was the biggest advocate for it. And I would go there because they had a shopping section, which was like a grocery store, and they had wild rice. They had bannocks in their bread departments and fry bread. Like it was like a native grocery store. And then they had like an art gallery on the top and then a buffet on weekends. And then it went under. After I left and then I heard it went under and I was like, you guys let this store go under. How dare you? And then I'm like, I'm the one who left too.
Was there a big like online presence at the time?
It was
maybe the time is right for it again, and maybe they can have more of an online customer base.
I fantasize about if I have to move back there, like that's what I'm going to try and re-erect, because it was one of my favorite places. And it was in a location where there's a lot of our houseless relatives living. Like that's where all the street people are. It's in like the neighborhood where all the old school bars were, like where my grandparents used to drink all the time. And I was such a big advocate for it. And it was called Nietzsche Commons. And it was my favorite place. And I still fantasize about reviving it one day if I run into a few million or something, you know, like revive that. Because, and the complaint that I heard from people was, one, they didn't like the location because it is in the quote unquote hood, which I don't care about, but I get a lot of people are used to their type of neighborhoods, but, and the price was a little bit higher than the usual grocery store, but I thought that was worth it to support.
Yeah. Well, is that very like cultural humility to, I don't know. I mean, it's fair to not ask your customers to endanger themselves, but how much of that is just perceived?
It was just perceived because I was someone who takes public transit and is out there walking, and it's really just our relatives who are out there that's quote unquote scaring people. Like they're, well, do you know what I'm talking about? Like they're out on the street.
Yeah, that's the perfect outlet for day old bannocks and fry breads, because
exactly
nobody likes day old fry breads and bannocks. So by the end of the night, then even those relatives are fed. I was giggling because when the Blackfoot Confederacy meeting started this morning, my fingers were all covered in bannock and fry bread, like flour. Because I bought hummus, but I didn't buy pita breads. And so I like bannock recipe is really similar to pita breads.
That's a good combo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, it was great to catch up with you, Suta Calling Last.
I know. I'm so glad to be back.
And I'm glad you're feeling better, because I remember seeing you like days after your surgery and you were just like still... You were like low energy and you look like yourself right now. I know this is an audio only podcast, but Suta is like back.
I had a surgery on my thyroid and I got half of it removed and the other half is like healthy and awesome. And so it's like a tough place to get a surgery, and I didn't heal as fast as they said I would heal. And so I was kind of bummed because I had work planned, you know.
Yeah.
Happy.
I had a little breakthrough when I was in the desert, and I wanted to share that I went to the bathroom outside in the middle of the night.
Oh my goodness.
In total darkness by myself. And I had to walk to where the bathroom was. And I remember thinking, Suta's going to be proud of me for getting out of my tent and not just like running scared, but I wasn't scared.
Wow.
It was peaceful. It was peaceful finally. So I think I've overcome my fear of quote unquote the wilderness from growing up in a city my whole life and never really spending, you know, overnights outside. I think I finally overcame that.
Yeah. Well, we have to be careful out in the dark, because that's when things that we don't know about as people or things that we're not used to seeing come out. And that's when they have their time. And so, you know, that's why we go in our lodges and close the doors. And
yeah, I totally believe that too. Like our time is daytime, but I had to go to the bathroom. And I remember just focusing on going to the bathroom. And I had the thought of, I'm just passing through, doing what I need to do, and then I'm going to go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about it. And I did get asked this past week at the training, like, how can you do night hikes? And because I was talking, about an old guy who went missing in Heart Butte and how I'm only 4 hours away. And if I had my live fine dog at the time, I'm also, I think, you know, I wouldn't say like expert, but I'm good at hiking night hikes. They don't scare me and they don't bother me. I kind of have a good eyeball on shadows. And if it's really an animal or if it's a tree type thing, you know, I don't get spooked very easily. And so I'm good with a headlamp. And if I had a dog, it's only a 4-hour drive for me. I think it took a day or two to find him, and he was alive, luckily, but it could have shortened the time significantly. And so I don't know if I'm going to be out there, you know, night hike rescuing, but I'm definitely not. And it definitely, like all of the searches that I'll join will be with the community or led by the community or the police. And so I'm never going to be out there by myself.
That's good to hear.
There'll always be some like authority. No, I don't think I can do that. Like I can be trained. So I got my doggy first aid and my dog center detection last week. And then in May, I'm recertifying. It's been years. I let it lapse for years. My first aid and backcountry wilderness.
Wow.
Search and rescue. Yeah. And so that teaches us how to like assess people out in the backcountry when help is 8 hours away or something like that. Or you have to use your GPS to call in something. but I do that because I was a backcountry hiker and I didn't want to be hurt. And I always felt like I hate feeling, this is my scripting, my grandpa from like 15 and maybe when I was younger, like 3, 4, because they wanted a boy, he would always say, I don't want you to be a helpless girl. I don't want you to be that girl on the side of the road, the helpless girl. And so I feel like I've always overcompensated. And since I'm the one out in the back country, I'll either be able to fix myself or I'll run across somebody that I'll need to fix up and drag out. And, you know, I'm excited to implement the idea of old school travoy, but I don't want to do it. I don't ever want to be in a situation where I have to make a travoy to carry out a person or a dog or anybody.
Yeah. But
I'm prepared if I have to.
Okay. So I know we were talking about the doom and gloom of like the environment and all the news that we're absorbing. And while I was actually scrolling, because Instagram is a wonderful place for quotes. I don't know how it compares to Facebook, but I find the most powerful quotes on Instagram. And somebody shared this beautiful quote that just reminded me of how brilliant Robin Wall Kimmerer is. And this is what her quote was from the Braiding Sweetgrass book was, even a wounded world is feeding us. Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy. I choose joy over despair, not because I have my head in the sand, but because joy is what the earth gives me daily and I must return the gift. And I thought that was a beautiful thing to share. Thanks for listening to the Indigenous Vision Podcast. We love your support and appreciate all of your likes, shares, and comments. Our next cultural humility training will take place at the end of May. So if you missed our first two trainings of the year, don't worry. We got you starting May 23rd. Details are available right now on our website, indigenousvision.org, or you can check out the links that I've shared in the show notes for this episode. Thank you so much for supporting us. Indigenous Vision loves you.